All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's J&EB Journal Club webinar, Journal Club 10, the final webinar in our fall series. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of S&EB and glad to have you joining us for this session today. If you look in your GoToWebinar toolbar, you will see the handout available, so you can go ahead and download the slides and follow along during the presentation. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question block so we can moderate those to our presenter today. When I close out the session, there'll be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session as well as any ideas you have on future Journal Club series topics. And then watch for an email from me. I'll try to have that out by the end of the day, Wednesday of this week. The email will include the link to the recording, the slide handout, as well as the CEU certificate that you would earn from your attendance today. Our moderator is under the weather today, so Ginger Quigg is not with us, but I am happy to do the bios of our speakers today. Marla Reichs has been a professor and extension nutritionist in the Department of Food, Science, and Nutrition at the University of Minnesota since 1990. Her research and programming interests include dietary behavior change for children and families, behavioral interventions to prevent weight gain among low-income, ethnically diverse families based on food-related parenting practices. She's published 110-plus peer-reviewed manuscripts based on this research and advised 50-plus graduate students to completion. Currently serving on the editorial board of the Journal of Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics is the Director of Graduate Studies in Nutrition. Dr. Reichs received her Ph.D. in nutrition from Iowa State University in 1985 and has been a registered dietitian for 40 years. Julie Reeder is the Senior Research Analyst with the State of Oregon WIC program. In her 14 years in this position, she's conducted multiple mixed method studies that explored breastfeeding, peer counseling, motivational interviewing, the WIC food package changes, and postpartum health. Current work focuses on better connecting WIC to healthcare and early learning initiatives. Julie is also Associate Editor for the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, a member of the National WIC Association Evaluation Committee, and serves on the expert panel advising Third National Survey of WIC participants. And finally, Megan Coker is a science librarian at the University of Minnesota, where she serves as subject librarian for the Department of Food, Science and Nutrition, Animal Science, and Soil, Water and Climate. Ms. Coker completed her master's degree in library and information science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and has received training in conducting systematic review searches through the University of Pittsburgh Health Science Library System. And thank you to our presenters today.
Well, thank you, Rachel. Also, thank you to everyone who is attending today. Our objectives for today, first we will describe the research that we reviewed that was published from 2011 to 2015 on cooking intervention outcomes. We previously reviewed the literature from 1980 through 2011, and this study is a follow-up to that. We'll be paying special attention to study design and the way the outcomes were evaluated in our presentation today, thinking about how these factors might impact the quality of the studies that we reviewed. And lastly, we'll talk about the implications based on our findings for future research and programs that include cooking activities. So we undertook our initial review because of the expansion in the use of cooking activities within nutrition education. We were interested in describing these studies and their impact. The obesity epidemic is thought to result in part because people are eating out more often and cooking less at home, and because youth and young adults are not learning to cook in school or from their parents as maybe they had in the past. So the premise is that if cooking skills and food skills that would include planning and shopping skills could be improved, then this would lead to improved dietary behaviors and better management of food resources. And then this in turn would lead to improvements in health and weight status, which in children could potentially track into adulthood. So other researchers had the similar ideas, I think, as you can see in this slide, where we show other recent reviews of the literature on the impact of cooking activities. So the reviews listed here include some of the studies that we included, but each research group seems to have taken a somewhat different approach to how they study this issue. So some have restricted their studies to one country, like the Reese et al. Study in the UK, or to community-based studies like the Garcia review, or some have described determinants of cooking, like the Mills Review. And Megan will now describe our approach and the methods that we used and some of the decision-making processes that we used.
All right. So the first thing we did was lay out our PICO. So our population, we wanted to look only at adult populations, and that could be clinical or a general audience. The interventions we were looking for were those that include a cooking component. So they didn't have to be solely a cooking intervention, but that had to be part of it. And for comparators or control, we would accept control group or one group pre-post design. And the outcomes we were looking for were both health improvements, nutrition, dietary intake, also prevention of illness and adverse events, accuracy, change in BMI. So in getting started, we first, you know, figured all of this out, and then we registered our protocol on Prospero, which is a registry for systematic reviews, and you can register them while they are in progress. And the nice thing about that is that you can see what other people are working on, and other people have a record of what you are working on as well. And then we also laid out in that our eligibility criteria for and our inclusion and exclusion criteria, and those actually were somewhat iterative in that we laid them out originally and then realized as we got into the papers that there were some contingencies we hadn't thought of. So what we wound up with in the end is what we started with, you know, we were limiting by year, so that's in terms of our search, because there was a previous study that looked at earlier years. We wanted only English-speaking, English-language articles, and published peer-reviewed articles. So that was ruling out great literature, conference proceedings, things like that. For inclusion criteria, again, we were looking only at outcomes for adults, so that those had to be reported. It could be observational or hands-on. And the outcomes had to apply to individuals participating in the cooking intervention. So that was something that came up where, you know, sometimes there would be studies with, you know, the parents or parents would take a class, but the outcomes would apply to children or things like that, or things that that got ruled out that didn't meet those inclusion criteria. And then exclusion criteria, obviously if children were the only target group, things that were not intervention studies, if there was not sufficient description of the cooking component, which is definitely something we encountered, things that were reports and recommending resources rather than interventions, studies without a cooking component, obviously, development of programs, and no evaluation measures, food safety as the only outcome, and outcomes not related to cooking. Like, we did run into some studies where cooking was used as a sort of behavioral therapy. And then in doing the search, so this is where I'll talk a little bit about my methods in constructing the searches that we used for this review. So first, we all consulted, and Marla brought a set of the types of articles we were looking for, and I used those with a tool. My link didn't show up here, but it's called the Yale Mesh Analyzer. You can Google that. And what that does is I can put in the PubMed IDs for a whole set of, I think, up to 20 articles, and it'll output a spreadsheet with the information about those articles, including the mesh subject headings. And so that gives me a sort of subject headings I want to look for in constructing a search. The next step is then to test those terms, to look for other terms in the databases, and then test them to see, you know, are these actually going to get the types of articles we want, run some example searches, and revise them. So with each database, they don't all work on mesh, so then we have to get different sets of subject headings, test terms again, and then finalize and run the searches. So with each of those steps, there was some back and forth about, you know, is this getting what we want, and tweaking those things to get the right subject heading. So this is an example of one search. So this was our Medline search, and the whole thing, you know, it's hard to see on here, but it is also attached with our Prospero registration. So if you look that up, there's a PDF attached with our Medline search. So you can see some of the things we wound up on. And in the end, I'm going to take you through our Prisma flow diagram for how we got from our initial, we wound up after deduplicating from all of those databases, we wound up with 3,047 articles. Oh, that was before deduplicating. After deduplicating, we were down to 2,365 articles. That was sort of our starting point for this. So the next step is screening the articles. So in this step, we then went through each of those 2,365, and two people looked at the titles and abstracts of each of those. So in our team of three, we broke it up so that two of us were looking at all of those. So and after the title and abstract review, we were able to exclude 2,273 articles. Some of the reasons, can I put notes for that? So most of that was just they didn't meet our inclusion criteria. They were not things about cooking interventions. So then we were down to 92 articles. And with those, we again assigned two people to each article, and we looked at those, the full articles to assess for eligibility. And then of those 92, 58 were excluded. Some were conference proceedings, some didn't meet inclusion, exclusion criteria. There were a couple cases where there were multiple publications on the same study. So those were reasons. And with that, we consulted amongst the three of us and decided which one made the most sense to include, which one had the best reporting, so that we could include that in our study. So those studies were included but not counted twice. So what we wound up with were 34 studies that for our final analysis. And of those, 11 were randomized controlled trials, 21 were before or after studies, and 2 were non-randomized controlled trials. So that was the set we were working with. As far as demographics of the people in the studies, I'm going to start with age. There were two studies that reported on adults and children, and for those, I just want to know, we only looked at the adult ages, so those aren't skewing our age ranges in here. 23 of those studies reported the mean age of participants, and I made a little chart of that so you can sort of see that it ranged from mean age of 35 to 77. And skewed a little towards the older end on some. 11 of those didn't give the mean age, so 2 of them were defined by the children and not the ages of the parents. So the parental ages weren't given. They were just saying, you know, we looked at parents of children in this age group. sorry, I have a little cold. And then in the remaining 9 studies, they did look at adults but didn't give a mean age on those. In terms of gender, these studies did skew female. There were 2 studies that were 100% male, and those were, I believe, both looking at prostate cancer. But the rest of the studies had participants were over 50% female. 6 of them had 100% female populations they were looking at for various reasons. 4 of them didn't report their percentage gender breakdown. And then the populations we were looking at, there were several different clinical populations, so I've listed those here. We had cardiovascular disease, breast cancer. 4 of the studies were looking at elderly or pre-frail populations. 5 of them were on type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome had 1, overweight and obese patients were 3 studies, and 1 was on prostate cancer patients. 16, I have that in the middle, there were 16 studies with healthy or no restrictions. Many of those were also looking at, well, they weren't defined by a clinical populations. Several of those were looking at low-income populations, so 9 of our studies were looking at low-income, were targeting low-income populations. And then, I guess this is the last one on my slides, the study location. So by and large, 15 of our studies were in the U.S. The rest, you can see in this chart, this is where the studies took place. So largely the U.S. and then 3 in the U.K. and 1 or 2 in each of these other countries listed. All right. And now Julie's going to take you through more information.
Okay. And so moving forward, talking a little bit more about the geographic locations, you can see that actually Minneapolis and the Minnesota area is sort of the epicenter of adult cooking research, but we also have New York City, Indiana, Maryland, South Carolina, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. So, of course, I noted that the West Coast wasn't having any studies at this time. We also had representation from the Netherlands and Italy and Scotland, Denmark, Sweden, and the UK, and quite a few interesting articles from the Asia and Pacific region, including India, Australia, Indonesia, and a couple of studies from Japan as well as Micronesia. We had one study from Canada, and we also had an online course that was more of an international course that had outreach to 80 countries. As far as study settings, it was quite varied, and that made it interesting in many ways. We had a couple that were village-level interventions where the entire village was the study group of interest. We also had quite a few that were cooperative extension services classes. We had courses, again, that were specific for a particular condition. So we had one for blood pressure. We had one for prostate cancer. In a couple of cases, it wasn't really specified where the intervention took place. Even after reading through the article multiple times very, very clearly, it wasn't clear where the intervention occurred. We also had one that happened at African Methodist Episcopal Churches, training for church cooks. We did adult education centers. We've done online. We've done congregant or home-delivered meals. We had two that took place in home and one that was a home and hospital intervention. We've got mobile integrated health centers. We had an intervention that was with volunteer firefighters. Child care, we had a housing complex sited intervention. We've had diabetes education. We had two that were within teaching kitchens, either private or were within the grocery store. We had a community-run pharmacy, and we had a research center as well. So we just had the whole world of possible intervention settings for the studies that we reviewed. So what was the focus? Well, unfortunately, in 5 of the papers, it was kind of unclear what the ultimate outcome of interest was, and that was a challenge. Most of them had some sort of a hands-on cooking experience, but again, as mentioned and will be mentioned again, sometimes the details about what was included in that hands-on cooking experience was a bit lacking. And 8 of them had, as far as we could tell, were more demonstration-only versus hands-on cooking. 14 of them were interested in some sort of change in consumption of food items, primarily fruits and vegetables, or the stated intention to change food item selection. 6 focused on specific changes in cooking skills, so maybe cooking self-efficacy, and the others really focused on something related to clinical outcomes, so it could be BMI, it could have been risk for diabetes, heart health knowledge, cardiovascular disease risk, or sodium and blood pressure. Many of these interventions had other components, and sometimes much larger components in this other area compared to the cooking intervention. So there was a lot with physical activity, sometimes gym memberships, pedometers. People had one-on-one counseling. They were given written and online educational materials. A few had telephone coaching, one-on-one telephone coaching as well. They had a mindfulness practice in one particular clinical study, a diabetes education, one-on-one and in group, and also medication management. One had a gardening component and a cookery component, and there was also one that involved a family level intervention, and that included some parenting pieces as well. So a lot of other things went on in the studies that we reviewed beyond just cooking. Okay, so for theoretical frameworks, unfortunately in 21 of the 34 studies, none was cited. We did have a few where some sort of theoretical framework was mentioned, but it was unclear how that was integrated into the intervention or evaluation. So something was said about a theoretical framework, but we didn't see that reflected in the rest of the article. Most common was social cognitive theory and stages of change, trans-theoretical model, if there was a theory mentioned. Adult learning theory came up. Social cognitive theory, goal setting, and Contento stepwise nutrition education planning procedure was mentioned. Again, self-efficacy and components of social cognitive theory, interactive learning theory, community-based participatory research, social marketing theory. One person mentioned the logic model, which isn't a health behavior theory, but at least had some framework. And then we had one that just had multiple theoretical approaches and frameworks. But again, the majority didn't have any sort of theoretical framework that we could identify. Okay, so duration of interventions, boy, we had a great variety of duration. So one was just a half-day workshop. Many were sort of in the 3 to 6 week range, and you can see there on the right-hand side of the slide. So, you know, it was 4 to 8 weeks, and that was 2 weekly sessions. We just had 4 weeks, but we couldn't figure out what the frequency or intensity was. And so that went up through about, you know, 10 or 11 weeks. And then on the next slide, you can see some longer-term interventions and that intensity. And so we had some that went up, you know, to 5 and 6 months, 5 months, 10 sessions. We had 6 months, mostly 90-minute sessions, and so there was an incredible variety of how long the intervention was delivered and what that intensity of delivery was. We did have one study that went up to 5 years, although it wasn't specified what occurred exactly during that 5-year time period. Okay, and now we'll move to Marla with some outcomes.
So the next slides are arranged. There's a group that are arranged that give more detail about the outcome, what was measured in terms of the outcome, then a group of slides talking about how it was measured, and then finally some results that we got from the measurements. Before I do that, I wanted to also mention that Julie mentioned there was a lot of variety in the duration of the interventions, but there was also a lot of variety in how often outcomes were assessed. So for about two-thirds of the studies, there were only pre-post assessments done, and then one study assessed outcomes only at post-intervention, and the remaining about one-third conducted some kind of follow-up after a pre-post. And these ranged anywhere from 2 months to 5 years, but most of them were at 6 or 12 months. So this first slide talks about dietary intake outcomes, and as Julie mentioned, there were a lot that had fruit and vegetable intake as an outcome. So there were 18 studies that measured fruit and or vegetable intake. Others included energy intake, which is reasonable because there were about a third of the studies that also measured some kind of change in weight outcomes. And then other foods or food groups or meal patterns assessed were sugar-sweetened beverages, whole grains, breakfast consumption, local fish, seafood, sodium salt. Five studies included a list that contained a number of various eating behavior changes. Two studies looked at parent feeding practices, and then two used an adherence score. This was related to either following the guidelines for cancer prevention or for eating whole foods or following a moderate fat diet. Another assessed intake based on a ratio of animal to vegetable protein that was consumed, and then others looked at whether people were eating fewer meals with meat, eating two or more meals a day, and then also portion control behaviors. Seven studies looked at outcomes that were related to cooking confidence or frequency of cooking. Seven examined knowledge changes, and those varied from basic nutrition knowledge regarding vitamin and mineral contents of foods to food preparation knowledge, so a wide variety of types of knowledge. And then two studies described measures that evaluated attitudes and beliefs, and only one examined changes in foods that were purchased using grocery receipts and also changes in household food security. About one-third of all of the studies, as I mentioned before, collected information on weight, height, or other anthropometric data. Six included physical activity measures. Others included clinical outcomes like blood pressure, quality of life, blood glucose, sodium excretion, cardiovascular outcomes, metabolic syndrome. Changes. So now I'll talk about how all of these outcomes were assessed and the types of measurement instruments. So changes in diet were assessed in a number of ways, most commonly including food frequency instruments, food recalls, and 24-hour recalls, and food records. Others asked questions about the intake of specific foods, and for all of these methods, most studies provided references for the original sources of the instrument, how it had been used in the past, or how it had been validated or tested. But for another 11 papers, intake or eating behavior questions were used, but there was no information provided about how the questions had been tested or used previously. For three of the studies that measured cooking confidence and cooking outcomes, the measures were reported to have been tested, but for the other three, there was no information on previous use or testing. And then for the studies that tested knowledge, only two provided information about the source of the instrument or items or pre-testing. For other outcomes, for example, two papers looked at feeding practices, psychosocial items or questions about behaviors, only a few of these provided information about pre-testing for reliability or validity or provided the source of the instrument or the source of the items. Other outcomes regarding food security, nutrition assessment, health-related quality of life, and number of cardiovascular events were assessed with instruments that had been validated or had the reliability established or at least referenced other people using the method. For physical activity, this was assessed in a variety of ways. For three studies, they used instruments or questions that had been used previously. For the others, no information was provided about the testing. So now for the results or our summary of our evidence. The results for changes in fruit and or vegetable intake were mostly positive. That was based both on control studies and single group studies. And some of these also showed improvements in specific aspects regarding fruit and vegetable intake, like intake of targeted fruits and vegetables or intake of a greater variety, and like intake with a meal, so intake of fresh fruits and vegetables with dinner. So several studies looked at energy intake, and this was decreased in most of the studies that reported it. Only one study showed an impact when they looked at nutrients such as fat, saturated fat, and cholesterol, and then others didn't report differences in these nutrients. For sugar-sweetened beverages, studies didn't generally show a positive impact also for alcohol. And then one study showed an improvement in an adherence score, the other did not. And then several studies showed improvements in meat and fish intake. So both studies that looked at whole grain foods showed positive changes. The results for other specific outcomes were mixed, with improvements in portion control behavior, decreased sodium or salt intake, but no difference in breakfast consumption. Most of the physical activity measures showed improvements. Also, changes in feeding practices were improved, and food security and food purchasing was improved. Most of the outcomes from single group studies that looked at cooking confidence and skills showed positive changes, including cooking measures like cooking from scratch, following a recipe, planning healthy meals, also eating out less frequently or eating ready-made foods less often. For knowledge, this was improved in most of the studies where it was assessed regarding micronutrients, benefits of healthy eating, eating with diabetes, heart health recommendations, but results for the studies that looked at attitudes were mixed. Several studies, as I mentioned, looked at a list or a battery of items, and for most of these studies, the behaviors related to healthy cooking practices and eating changes were generally positive. For weight and other anthropometric outcomes, results were mixed. Positive findings were more evident in the single group studies than in control studies. For clinical outcomes, most of the studies regarding these outcomes showed positive changes. In the slide here, the blood pressure changes were not necessarily positive, but most of the other physical activity, physical component scores, hand grip strength, blood glucose, and cardiovascular events, days in hospitals were all improved. And then lastly, the other clinical outcomes, these results were mixed with few positive changes. So the mini nutrition assessment score, no change, blood pressures, some change, some not, variable changes in metabolic syndrome, health-related quality of life were improved in both groups with no difference between groups. The number of cardiovascular events did decrease in intervention versus control, but for the most part, all of these changes were pretty much, the results were pretty much mixed. So now, I think, Julie, you were going to do the discussion? Are you there?
I am here. I had to unmute myself. Taking a look at the results of the previous reviews, there is an increasing number of studies published with cooking components, and so this has shot up. There were 27 studies from 1980 to 2011 based on Marla's review in 2014, and yet now we've had 34 studies from 2012 through 2015. So there's definitely increased interest. And as we'll talk about here in a minute, the reviews are not able to determine best practices. And there is a study with McGowan et al. In 2015 looking at the use of specific best practices. So some of the issues that we ran across was, is the exposure adequate? And so we looked at with the duration that there was quite a variety of both the length and the intensity of the intervention, and so it was challenging to determine whether that was a long enough and intense enough intervention to be able to expect significant outcomes. Also, another issue that came up was outcomes based on dietary behavior change versus cooking outcomes, and really with most of the studies that we reviewed, there were a limited number that really looked at cooking outcomes alone, so cooking self-efficacy or changes in cooking skills. A lot more were focused, again, on like fruit and vegetable or sodium reduction or meat or animal protein reduction. Also, we noticed that our audience, primarily for these interventions, was mainly women and primarily lower-income individuals. And even when we did have a couple of studies that the intervention was with men, they were asked to bring their partner along, and so it seemed like the intervention may also be with women, with female partners in that particular case, and not just men alone. The other concern that came up, the limitations, as we've mentioned throughout the webinar, is a lack of control groups in many of our studies, particularly for some of our community versus clinically based interventions. Lack of use of tools that had been proven valid and reliable, that was a challenge. And so we were more likely to see tools that had validity and reliability for that population in the clinical trials. Our GEMs, great educational materials, things that were shorter pieces, were less likely to give us information about whether or not the tool had been validated at all, much less in that particular study population. We have a mix of results, and some of them are stronger and some of them are modest, but we have studies that show both results happening at the same time, positive and negative, on different factors, and we have a mix of results between studies. Another limitation is that we don't see a lot of intention to treat analyses, so we just see data on the completers, and sometimes that has some self-selection bias about who opts in and then who stays in the intervention, and we do have some significant loss to follow-up in some of the studies. So some of the issues that we ran across when we were trying to assess the interventions and the quality interventions is that the cooking components were not adequately described, and that was difficult then to assess what really had occurred, whether it was just a demo, how much hands-on cooking occurred, and what that was comprised of. It wasn't also clear oftentimes who delivered the cooking intervention. Some specify that it was a registered dietitian or a professional chef that conducted the cooking lessons and did hands-on, but in other cases that was not specified. Most of the studies lacked any sort of theoretical foundation for the intervention, so that was a significant limitation. Some with the community-based samples were harder to assess what exactly was delivered to different participants and in what ways. I think the other big piece was that the studies had a lot of different components occurring, so it was hard to say whether the cooking component, which often was a smaller component in a larger clinical intervention, to say whether that was the responsible piece for any changes that might have occurred, versus medication management, a free gym membership, a lot of physical activity pieces. So that was definitely something that would make it challenging to assess just the cooking piece. So as far as implications and our recommendations, I would say both for fellow researchers and also practitioners thinking about doing evaluation, that there's a significant need to improve the quality of the study design that we use to evaluate and show the impacts of cooking intervention. I might also encourage you to think beyond the typical audience that was the target of most of our studies, which is lower-income women. And so it would be great to include more interventions with men and maybe look at higher-income individuals outside of a medical setting as well. I'd also say that there's a need for studies that look more at cost-effectiveness analysis. So of those who receive a cooking intervention, particularly when we're interested in a clinical outcome, what is the cost to deliver that intervention, and what would be expected cost savings, if any, from clinical aspects, so a reduction in blood glucose or glucose diabetes medication, for example. Also, it would be good if we could design some studies that let us measure the impact of each component. So as I mentioned before, a lot of these studies had multiple types of interventions, and yet it's not possible for us to really say that this component yielded this particular impact. And so being able to pull things apart and be able to calculate or have an idea of which components are the most important would be very helpful. Another piece that came up was statistical versus practical or significant difference. And so there were some things that were statistically significant impacts, but from a clinical standpoint or a practical standpoint, perhaps increasing vegetable intake by 1 to 2 tablespoons a day, for example, may not have a lot of clinical significance. So studies that look at the practical or the clinical, as well as just looking for statistical significance, would add a lot of information going forward. Finally, as we've mentioned before, that it's quite challenging from the literature, and this was not the purpose of our systematic review, but based on our review, we feel like it would be challenging to come up with a set of best practices for practitioners. So if you were to ask us, I'm going to do a cooking intervention, what do you think are the most important components? That would be challenging for us to recommend given the limitations of some of the studies that we reviewed. And so to let you know what next steps are, we are finishing our quality analysis, and we're using the evidence analysis library from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And so we're going through each of the 34 studies that we've talked to you about today, and we are rating different aspects of the quality of those studies. And I think I've mentioned a lot of the challenges to you, a lack of control group, a lack of intention to treat analysis, tools that haven't been validated or are not validated for the population in which that they were used, a lack of blinding, so the researcher not being blinded to who is in which intervention group and participants not being blinded to what group that they're assigned to as well. And I understand that many times in our community-based interventions that's not possible, but it's something for us to consider. And if you haven't visited the evidence analysis library and looked at some of their quality checklists, I would invite you to do that so you can see what we're looking at and get some ideas for your next study on how to improve the quality. And with that, we're providing you with all of our references so you can see the studies that we reviewed. And I think that we're about ready to take questions. We went through a lot of information quickly, so we're happy to open it up to your questions now.
Excellent.
And Marla and Megan, please add anything.
Oh, yeah, okay. Definitely. I was going to say, I don't have any questions yet, so we'll give folks a minute to type. Someone is asking about the McGowan 2015 study, or where is the study?
Where?
Can you hear us?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're on good.
It's in the third slide, I think, one of the references in the list of reviews.
Yeah.
You wanted to know where it was published?
Yeah, that's the question. So it is listed among the in the references for that, so that they could find that.
It's listed on the third slide. There's a list of references for previous reviews. It's not in the our reference list. Our reference list is only the 34 studies that we reviewed. But I'm trying to look at it on paper to see if I can see where it was published. But
oh, there, I see it. Like.
Yeah, so it's in Critical Reviews of Food Science and Nutrition, and the last time I looked, which was recently, it still is EPUB ahead of print, so it's like 90 pages because it's all double-spaced and difficult to print and read, but it's really good paper because they look not just at the types of cooking skills and domains that are used in terms of best practices, but they also have a really good review of the types of evaluation tools that are used to get at cooking outcomes, like the cooking confidence and frequency and those kinds of things.
Excellent. I have a question. Was there a duration of intervention that seemed to be the best?
Yeah, from my opinion, this is Julie, I would say that we weren't able to determine that, and that was a challenge. But Marla and Megan, do you have thoughts on that differ?
No, it was really varied, like you said. You know, I would think that the more exposure and the greater the intensity, the more effective it would be. But I think you're right, Julie. I don't think there's any way we can say that so many lessons over a certain period of time is better or most optimum.
Right. Unfortunately, we don't know.
Yeah, it'd be very specific, according to the content and the audience and the instruction and all that.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. We have another question. Seems like the limitations point to the need for a study that would look at a few widely disseminated cooking interventions and compare over a few years the common factors, i.e. best practices, and maybe idiosyncratic factors, but not sure who would fund this type of research.
That is a good question.
Yeah, And you know, there has been funding at the national level through Cooking Matters. So Cooking Matters has been evaluated on a national level by Share Our Strength. But but that's just one type of intervention, and it's typically in a community level, not controlled. So, but that is just one place where I think of where there is funding.
That is the only one that I am aware of too, is that particular large scale from Share Our Strength.
I have another question. If you were, did someone have something to add?
I think that it would be good to pursue some opportunities for that, and you know, perhaps through some either accountable care organizations in your state that might be interested in looking at cooking interventions as part of their clinical interventions. Perhaps they would fund some research. Go ahead, Rachel.
Okay. No, we had another question. If you were designing a program now, what would you do?
Well, I think one of the important things is to know your audience needs. So it would be best to know what types of information or behavior change or whatever is most likely to help improve quality of life and the types of outcomes that you're interested in, and then go from there. So a really good needs assessment in order to determine those kinds of things. Also to be really familiar with the literature so that you can see what other people have done and maybe some things that were effective versus others that were not.
I would agree with everything that Marla just said, and then I would think after that needs assessment and after becoming really familiar with what has already been done and published on, I would think choosing a health theory as a framework would be key, because we saw that as a limitation in a lot of the studies, and I think that would strengthen the quality of your intervention and also your evaluation. So I think having a theoretical basis would be a good recommendation.
Okay.
There have been more papers published that are reporting the use of tested and reliable instruments. So in that, whatever you're planning, if you can choose instruments that have already been developed that are valid and reliable, or else do that validity and reliability testing yourself.
Excellent. Which of the interventions showed the greatest improvement in nutrition, and did you use any way to quantify nutritional improvement?
I don't know if I can answer that without doing a little more digging and looking over the studies. Nothing really stands out as being the one that would have the best, and I guess it depends on what we think of as nutrition. Because some of the studies were only trying to change fruit and vegetable intake, and then others were much broader, and they would collect the 24-hour recalls and then look at a lot of other things besides food group intake. So something that had broader level of outcomes might give you the best information about nutrition, but I don't know if I can say right now without looking at it in more depth which one was most positive if it had broader outcomes. I do think that the ones that we can put our most trust in would be the ones that are controlled, just because those are stronger designs. And there were a lot of studies that were not controlled that had positive outcomes, but they're not as strong in terms of your ability to believe the outcomes if there wasn't a control group.
I think the other piece of that would be, again, how we're sort of defining nutritional impact. As Marla mentioned, there were a number of studies that did have a control group that were randomized control trials that we might have a little more confidence in, but there isn't anything that stands out to me either about who was able to produce the greatest results. And then, and again, in many of the studies, especially the clinical trials, there were a lot of other components there, so it makes it hard to separate sometimes the cooking component from the other larger components of the intervention.
We have a question that asks, is it possible that the participants in the studies were not at the action stage of change and therefore were not able to benefit from the intervention? Do you have any thoughts about the importance of assessing what stage of change the person is in?
I think that's a good point. And there was one study that used stages of change, or one or two maybe, but you're always better off knowing your audience, and if people are not willing and ready and aware of the need to change, then you're not going to be as effective as if you're working with a group that's at that action stage and no longer just contemplating. So I think that's a great idea if you can. I think we could look again at our those papers that did include that. Julie, do you remember which studies were based on?
I'd have to pull that up again to look at that. And I think they were based on stages of change, but I do not recall if they did a stages of change assessment with each participant as our question is based. But I think that's an excellent point. We did have a couple studies, too, where people would have really been towards the action stage. For example, the one that dealt with people who had failed a traditional prostate cancer intervention. And so that group was highly motivated, I think, which hurts the generalizability a bit if you were to scale up the intervention. So, but I think that's a wonderful point that, yes, there wasn't a lot of assessment. And that goes back to Marla's comment about what would you do if you were designing something now. And I think a lot of needs assessment work, what really are the interests and needs of the particular audience that you're working with, and perhaps what is their readiness for change. I think that would be very important.
And Megan did talk about how there were 16 of these studies that were for a general audience and the rest were more clinical, medical. And like you said, Julie, I think those that are attending cooking classes or nutrition ed classes because they have a clinical, medical issue may be more motivated. Unless we, you know, talk about how benefits of these kinds of classes might be better food resource management if you have a low-income audience. Otherwise, people really need to be motivated because they want to change their own eating patterns. And then there were a couple papers that were for overweight only, overweight or obese only, and they may be part of that intervention because of some motivation for better health too.
I agree, absolutely. Other questions?
Yeah, I was going to say, I've got some thank yous coming into my chat box, but I don't have, here we go. Are you planning to conduct a similar review, or does one exist for child-adolescent audiences?
There is a review. It was published by Hirsch et al. In Preventing Chronic Disease a couple years ago. I don't have the reference with me, but that has been done. But again, that's a few years old now. I don't know if anyone. I'm not planning to to do it. I don't know of anyone who is. But I'm more familiar with the intervention research for adults.
Yeah, I'm not planning on doing that. Although I guess coming from WIC, that might not be a bad idea to look at the child intervention. But I guess whoever's question that is, go for it.
Well, very good. If anyone has any other questions, please type those. I'll just go ahead and give you the reminder that watch for your email on Wednesday of this week. I'll have a link to the recording, the slides, and your CEU certificate. And then there'll be a short survey when I close out the webinar, and we appreciate your feedback. Very busy webinar week for SNEB. On Wednesday, we have a session on probiotics. That is actually open to members and non-members. So if you know of anyone interested in that topic, I encourage you to have them register for the webinar. And then Friday, the communications division is doing a skills-building webinar on selecting the right images for your messaging. And then, like I mentioned, this is the final journal club of the fall semester. We have the spring semester schedule in hand. We're going to do 11 sessions looking at policies, systems, and environmental change initiatives and programs to improve health. Our first webinar will be on February 6th. So I'll have a link in the follow-up email if you want to go ahead and get registered for the sessions in the spring. Otherwise, I don't see any questions, so I will say thank you very much to all of our presenters today for a very interesting session, and we appreciate your insights on this topic.
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.